So today's Tuesday, the 5th of September, 2023. This is an online audio recording via Teams. My name is Professor Nigel Lynge, and I'm representing the IET today. And it's my great pleasure to be talking to Professor Andy Valdar. So good afternoon, Andy.
Good
Welcome to
afternoon.
this interview, which is part of the oral history project that the IET is running, where we're very interested in talking to people about their experiences of how they became aware and got involved with the IET, and of course, how the IET has helped them progress through their career. So it would be useful if we could just start by you just telling us your current position and your brief summary of your career history.
Well, yes, thank you, Nigel, and thank you for inviting me to give this to join your interview. So my history really splits into two halves. The first half of my career was working for what was initially the GPO. I joined the GPO in 1969, and then for 30 years I worked for them. Going throughout the engineering hierarchy within VT. And I left in 1999 and joined UCL with the remit at the time to run MSc courses specifically for VT. So it was a joint thing there. And I actually retired from UCL in 2013, but I've carried on working with them. So they were given, as soon as I joined UCL, I was given the basically an honorary title of visiting professor, and I still have that, which I'm very proud of. So essentially, that's my role. So even though I was working full time for the university, I still just carried the visiting professor title at the time, and so I'm still involved in lecturing and supervising students doing their MSc projects.
That's excellent. So that's you say two careers in one, really. The engineering career with the GPO becoming BT, and then an academic career, although very closely linked with BT all the same. So that's an interesting development there. But I wonder how, if you could tell us how it all started. How did you get into engineering in the first place? What drove you to want to become an electrical engineer or work in telecommunications?
Well, there are two things there. The first is I was, in hindsight, lucky to fail my 11 plus.
I don't hear many people say that.
Because in 1958, I moved. I failed the 11 plus, but they had just opened up a technical school, which was essentially comprehensive, but it was technical, and it was an excellent school in many ways. And one of the things we did there, and I got an O level in engineering drawing,
Okay, good.
Which was very useful when I got to university. So that gave me some ideas about being a draftsman and so forth. And so that was, even to this day, I find that useful. First point, I got an O level in elementary surveying, which is again, so I was going to be an architect initially. So you can see
Okay.
how I, a little bit like all teenagers, it fluctuated. It turned out I was actually very lucky because it had a sort of engineering bias, and they actually had not only woodworking but metalworking and also car mechanics going on at the school, as well as proper academic A level. So I did my pure maths and applied maths at A level and physics as well. So it was an amazing mixture. It was all boys school. Even though it was a comprehensive school, the masters all wore their gowns every
Yes.
morning and so forth. That gave me a sort of bias towards the sort of engineering technical side, number one. Number two, my father had always been interested in radio. He used to build radios from practical wireless and
Oh,
other
yes.
magazines way back when. And I remember him with the great big valve radios and so on we're working on. So I got an interest there. He got me interested in how simple telephones worked. And the reason being that there was a lot of equipment at army surplus shops. Don't forget, this was the 1950s.
Indeed.
And in the 1950s, there was all sorts of equipment, RAF radio transmitters, of which I used to have one for many years, and all sorts of things. So I was always dabbling. And so the two things together gave me that interest. And then the next thing that happened, which was extremely important, again, the one of the reasons I'm talking to you now, I would imagine, is that the Robins Committee set up and advised the government to improve their training of engineering on the engineering side. And they converted, I think it was six CATS, Colleges of Advanced Technology, into universities, of which Salford was one.
That's right.
And the one I went to, which was Loughborough, was another one.
Yes. Yes.
And I think City University was another, and so on. So that gave me an opportunity to get into university, but on the engineering side. And the two things sort of fitted quite nicely. So here was the opportunity of now doing proper technical degrees on the one hand, given my sort of rather biased school upbringing on the one hand, and and the availability of the CATS, so that was very helpful.
That's fascinating, because I did engineering drawing, and I think it's a greatly undervalued subject, actually, because I've constantly find that what I learned in that subject incredibly valuable, actually. So I too support engineering drawing as a subject. And of course, also, it's from what you were saying, it's almost like a hobby becomes a career. You were dabbling, you were using surplus equipment and going to what I assume was sort of surplus shops and buying bits and pieces and having a go. So you go off to Loughborough then. And what did you choose to study at Loughborough?
Well, it was so I chose Loughborough. I also chose Salford, but they didn't select me. But I think that's I think because it was my sixth choice. But anyway.
Oh, I see. Right.
So I went to Loughborough and I took a 4-year sandwich course, which I got a student apprenticeship with Thorn Electrical Industries at the same time. And so I did a 1 year in industry, but it was actually spread. It was every third term was actually spent in industry.
Okay.
It wasn't a full year out. It added up over the 3 years to 4 years.
Did we call that a thin sandwich at the time? Was that...
They called it a thin sandwich.
Thin sandwich course, yes.
It's the same total amount of time, but what it meant was you never more than one term out of university, which was quite good, really.
Yeah.
But it also covered the summer holidays. You're working over the summer holidays.
Indeed.
So I did a student apprenticeship. So in the workshops there, milling and so forth, engineering drawing came in there again. Mm-hmm. And then I went through at that time, Thorn Electrical Industries had the first colour TV factory.
Right.
Which was quite exciting, with the big shadow mast, CRT tubes and so on. So it was a marvellous grounding. So I, gave me an understanding what industry looked like and so on, as well as some of the technical things, milling, grinding and all the rest of it.
And was Thorn at that time close to Loughborough, or was it in another part of the country that you had to go for this industrial experience?
I went actually up to Leicester. Their training area was in Leicester, which was extremely close to Loughborough.
Yes.
It was, 20 miles or something away, as it happens. So
yes.
So that was extremely useful. And when it came, so that gave me a 4-year course, and I got after the first year, they split you into ordinary or honours. And I went into the honours stream, and the degree I got was called a Bachelor of Technology.
Okay. Right. That's interesting.
Which was great then, But of course, that's BE, sorry, that's Bachelor and Tech, T-E-C-H. But, and of course, more recently, the BETEC has come out, which, yes, of course, is not the same level
it's
at all.
And not
I keep
at all,
on saying, no,
no,
it's not the same.
It's not a BTEC. It's a Bachelor
exactly.
of Technology. Yes.
So that's just one of the things. But anyway, on the other hand, the fact that I had a BTEC, the fact that I had done 1 year's industrial experience meant that when I applied to the GPO for joining as a graduate engineer,
yes,
they put me in at the higher level. I was only one of four people in that intake to go at the higher level because of my industrial experience.
So that's again though an interesting, slightly interesting jump, in the sense that Thorne was supporting you through the degree and training, and yet you chose the GPO. Was there a connection between
Thorne
Electrical and the GPO that caused that to happen?
You put your finger on it. It was a difficult time because when it came to the end of the degree, Thorne didn't really have an appropriate job to offer me. And at the time, there were lots of other opportunities. The GPO job, I was also offered a job with the electrical board as well, but the GPO job just addressed my interest in telecoms for a start and some of the electronic side, which Thorne, in terms of what they had available at the time, could not do. So it was a difficult decision, but sometimes you just have to make those decisions.
If they hadn't got an opportunity, then there's not a lot you can do, really. Now,
yeah,
in this story, you're at university doing this four-year degree with the industrial training. Where does the IEE, as it was then, come into the story?
Well, that's a good point, because I actually joined as a graduate the IEE back in 1969. So I was a student graduate, student undergraduate at the time. So I joined in 1969, and the reason I did that, it was greatly encouraged during the electrical engineering course that I was doing, that frequently there was reference to the fact that you chaps ought to be joining the IE. It's an important element in your career and your development, and that gave me the opportunity to actually join as an undergraduate. Greatly encouraged. I had someone to recommend me from the academic staff. And I'm very pleased to say that 50 years later, I received, out of the blue, I didn't expect it, from the IET then, my 50-year badge.
Well done. Yes, 50 years.
As a result of joining as a... So that was in 2019. As a result of joining then. So that was my first introduction as a graduate, student graduate at that time, my first introduction to what these institutions are all about.
I think I mirror that as well. You know, as a tutor at a university, encouraging students to join the appropriate professional body is part of the remit in a way. Obviously you encourage the students to get involved as a student member, and you hope that in your case it worked brilliantly. They stay with the professional body, and there you are, 50 years of service plus, of course, you're still there, being a benefit of the membership. I'm interested, when you joined the GPO then, you were obviously, they were interested in your degree, but did they take any notice of the fact that you joined as a student? Was that something that would have been regarded as a good thing, on a positive on your CV, do you think? Or
yes, it was, because the joining the GPO, I was actually interviewed in the offices below the BT tower, or the
right,
telecom tower as it was then. So we had 2 days of interviews, and one of the interviews was really trying to ascertain what's your attitude to the profession, what's your interest in this. And it certainly helped. I could say that not only had I done this work in industry and so forth, got my degree, I talked about what my project was in, which was they found interesting. But I also mentioned this relationship with the IEE then, and it definitely mm-hmm. helped just to show that, you know, I was taking things seriously.
Yes, yes. That's interesting. Yes, that's good to know. So you then joined the GPO and start your industry career with them. Now, obviously, you're still a student member, or you're a student member until you graduated. So as you're now working for the GPO, what's the relationship like between you and the IEE? How does that actually develop? Do you progress up the membership? Is it somehow linked to your work? Just tell us a little bit about those early days working for the GPO and that going from a student member towards the obviously the full membership.
Yes. Well, I joined the GPO in August 1969, and the first day I was there, I had to sign the Official Secrets Act, first point, mm-hmm. and I had to sign for membership of what was then known as the IPOEE,
okay.
Institute of Post Office Electrical Engineers, and the reason I mention it at that stage is it was just saying, look, you're joining the engineering, because the engineering hierarchy was quite separate to all the other hierarchies in the GPO at the time. So there's an engineering one, there was a finance, there was sales, there was traffic, and so on. And part of the engineering hierarchy was very much an interest in how are you taking your professionalism. So the first thing was there was BT's own
Yes.
Professional Institute, which was then known as the IPOEE, IPO. And that was very technical, and it tended to look at all the details of telecoms equipment and the way it was being deployed. And all the way through my early career within what was GPO, then became Post Office, then BT, there were... any promotion was based on a four-man promotion board, and you had to really mug up your technical knowledge. And of course, the magazine of the IPO then was what you used to give you the detail that could answer the question. So that was, you know, a bit of research before the board. That gives you the idea of the sort of the framework, the way that yeah. the engineers were looked at. Now, when I was actually started working in the engineering department, which was network planning in those days, at the headquarters, the next thing that happened was that they kept saying, as soon as you've got a bit of experience under your belt working for us, you should apply to become a full member of the IEE.
Right.
And it's one of those things that, you know, this is what you've got to do. You need to get. So I had to get a few years of experience under my belt, because this, when you come to apply for full membership, you've got to give some very good examples of how you've applied what you learned at university in an engineering job. And so to get those examples, you needed a bit of
absolutely
experience. Yeah. And that was made very clear to me right at the beginning. And that's useful because, you know, you have your goal set up. You know what you're trying to do. So I very much enjoyed that. After being a BT for 2 years, I was then sent on a full-time one-year MSc up at Essex University.
Okay.
In telecommunication systems.
Right.
And that was very good because I'm full pay and probably earning more than the lecturers, but that was a bit embarrassing. But it shows you that they took the engineering training very seriously, you know, to actually appoint something like probably each year 20 people to take time off from work on full pay to go and do a course that they paid for in all respects.
There's clearly a culture here, isn't there, within the organization?
It's a cultural thing, yes.
Yeah, of of sort of the standard that is expected of you almost.
Exactly. Exactly so. Yes. So that gave me the MSc in telecommunications, which was excellent. And then I went back into the network planning department, and in 1975, so I've now had something like, I joined 69, so but with 1 year out, about 5 years experience under my belt. I then went through the process of applying for full membership of the IEEE. And again, it was taken very seriously. And I was coached, sometimes spent coaching by not my immediate boss, who was Keith Ward, by the way, but but if you like, an uncle relationship.
Right.
One of Keith's peers in another part of the same organization, but another part. And he took me under his wing, and he used to get me, you know, to I drafted out my application, and he was going to be the seconder. And he called me in and said, no, this does, you haven't said what you've done, really. You haven't addressed the question and this sort of thing. And he spent a lot of his time. He was a busy senior engineer. A lot of his time, he coached me in how to apply for this. It's taken very seriously, the IEEE membership application form. And it was all about giving evidence of what did you do? What was the result of your efforts?
Yes.
And this sort of coaching. And again, I think that just highlights the point that you brought out as well, which was this sort of culture of, not only is it the right thing to do as an engineer, but we're going to give you some time and effort to do it.
And almost you ended up doing two membership interviews. You did one within PT, the mock interview. And then, of course, you do the real one with the institution itself.
Yes.
And you must have been incredibly well prepared. So you probably gave the IEEE assessors an easy time, because you knew exactly how to respond and behave.
It wasn't quite a smooth sailing, but it's essentially right. So I was very fortunate that I joined an organization with that culture.
Absolutely. Yeah. So obviously you get your membership, which comes with that, your chartered status, and you continue up through your career within British Telecom. But I just, you know, obviously becoming a member was important for you, as you've just explained, and I could tell the way you were describing it that it was important for you and it mattered.
Yes.
After you've got that, how does the relationship with the IEEE continue? You know, are you actively involved in some way, or is it just there in the background?
I went to a lot of their functions, which was, I always went to, for example, the new president's address.
Okay.
Which I found very interesting, and it was a good sort of meeting point as well. A lot of my colleagues, of course, were there as well. First point. And I went to a fair number of just made a remember something school. Yeah, I went to a number of their seminars as well. So it was, if you like, on a passive side, but I found it a very useful source of information. That continued for some time. I then applied after a number of years and got the fellowship, so I became a fellow of the IEEE as well. And again, there was a lot of pressure saying, well, look, you've got a senior position in BT now, you should really be a fellow. It was one of those things.
If you like, BT was proud. You're almost suggesting BT was proud of the fact that some of its staff had fellowship. Is that a fair comment? Is that
what... I Absolutely. Okay, yes.
That's interesting.
And don't forget, a lot of the time I was dealing with the people up at Martlesham, which was all the engineering side as well. So
on the research.
On the research side, yes. So that was.
So again, there's that encouragement from your employer to continue up through the grades of membership, up to fellowship, because they could clearly see it was important for them. The BT GPO was important for them.
I think so.
But also important for you to develop your professional career.
That's right. Absolutely. Yes. And one of the things that BT values is the ability to point people in different jobs. So although you've come up a particular route, once you get to a certain level, they like to be able to put you quite separate. So I was put in terms of, I even moved into marketing and product development and so on for a while. And so this is all about being able to deploy senior people in that way. And again, I think the professionalism helped there. Yeah.
Excellent.
Carry on. No, I was going to say that I also had, I was lent onto Commonwealth by, well, the British government at the time, to work for the United Nations in India for 3 years.
Oh, really? Right. Whereabouts in India were you deployed?
So I worked for the UN Development Programme in New Delhi, and they set up a training college in telecommunications for what was then the Indian Post Office, or the P&T, Post and Telecoms, I called it. And that was in 1977. So I was a full member of the IE at that stage. So in 1977 to 1980, I lived with my family in India and worked full time in New Delhi. And the new college was set up in a place called Ghaziabad in Uttar Pradesh, which is at the adjacent state to Delhi. Interestingly, there was an IE presence in India also at the time.
Yes, yes. I was going to say, I'm sure they have.
Yeah.
Do you think your membership had any bearing on this appointment?
I can't say it did, but I can say that when I got to India, the fact that I was a full member of the IE at the time, because I also interacted with lots of people in the Indian P&T on the telecom side, including their research stage, their research department, who were also IE members. And we would talk about, you know, one of the things we would talk about is sort of professionalism and so on. So it was, again, helpful there. It gave me a sort of, I had other things as well, but it made me bona fide, if you like.
A status. Yes.
I mean, I had the fact I was working for British Telecom, which was quite a status in itself. The fact that I was working on digital switching was something that they also liked. And so it all sort of came together. Professionalism on the one side with the IE, and the, you know, the background and the position of my work in BT. So it was a good period. Enjoyed
Excellent.
That.
Yes. And I wonder, you must have been responsible for junior staff as you got more senior within BT.
Yes.
Did you continue the tradition of encouraging those in junior positions to use you as an example and follow the path that you had done? Did the culture continue?
The culture did continue. Yes. At one time, I had a department of nearly 100 engineers, which was, you know, that quite a responsibility.
Absolutely.
There's some very good people there, including Roger Ward and Tim Wright as well.
Right,
so
yeah.
So it was a responsibility, and we did take it. You're right, you put your finger on it. To me, it was a value. The problem was, it was a value to have this professionalism. The problem was, the whole culture was changing during the period. You know,
yes.
I was very lucky. I was there in the 60s and the 70s, the end of the 60s, the 70s and the 80s. By the time you come to the 1990s, when BT became privatized,
yes,
when a lot of the engineering hierarchy was merged into all the other hierarchies, so a lot of this sort of engineering culture, it got, I suppose, it got thrown away, almost like a cultural revolution.
Right, right.
Our own cultural revolution took place, and like always, a few babies got thrown out with the bathwater, I think. So it wasn't such a high status given within the current BT and the emerging BT at that stage to institute membership. That was less valued, I would say.
Okay.
You didn't get the sort of budgetary support in terms of time off or expenses to go and attend a seminar or so, and all those things gradually got cut out. And so, however, I did try my best to use some of my budget to support the young engineers. And every year I would give a sort of bursary to one or two of them to attend for an external course or to attend various seminars and so on. And then that included going abroad to attend to FTSE congresses, by the way.
Oh, right. Excellent. Right.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you mentioned right at the beginning, you've had this dual career of industry. We've talked now about the GPO, Post Office Telecoms becoming British Telecom. And then you moved to academia and you joined UCL. How does your relationship with the IEE / IET change when you're based within a university? Is there any difference? Does it change in any way?
That's a good question. And I would say yes. Whereas within BT, I think I talked about the Cultural Revolution and so on, where the importance of those institutions has been diminished. In the academic world, I discovered that it's still as strong as ever.
Okay.
And as you know, all our courses, well, as you probably know, I'm sure yours are as well, are IET accredited.
Indeed, yes.
And so I got quite heavily involved in dealing with the IET on the accreditation side, mm-hmm, for a new MSc that I was introducing and then running. So I, if you like, I saw the IET from the other side.
Right, and, yes.
So it was very much central to life within the academic side within UCL, as far as I could see.
Well, certainly accredited, professional body accreditation, talking as someone whose career is in universities, I absolutely second the importance of that for whatever discipline of engineering or computer science that one is talking about. I just wonder, with regard to IEE, IET accreditation, did it help, do you think, that you had long-standing membership of the professional body? Did that give you any advantage, you think, in terms of not necessarily giving them an easy ride or anything like that? I don't mean that. Yeah. I mean, having an insight into perhaps what the IET was looking for in a degree course, because you have got that professional engineering experience.
I think it helped me, particularly in, as you know, with accreditation on the courses, there's some certain criteria that you have, yes, to respond against and so on. And going back to the schooling I had in BT in how to address those sort of questions from an institution like the IEE or the IET now, it's all about saying something and then using some evidence to prove what you've just said. For example, such and such happened, which illustrates my point.
Yes.
And from that point of view, that gave me, I think I was better, I might be wrong, at answering and giving the information into the accreditation team than maybe other people might have been because of my background there. Wasn't necessarily any advantage being a fellow, although it didn't do any harm to put that down on the form. But I think it was my experience in, as I say, being coached all the way through my BT career in how to answer those questions.
That's yeah, I can understand that. That's good. Now, in terms of obviously the IET, you talked about attending their seminars and going to the presidential address and so on. Did you ever get involved on the volunteering side and get involved in a committee at local or national level? Did you ever get involved in that side of the business?
Well, the answer is I certainly put myself up for re-election once I joined as a member, and that was back in the 70s. I put myself up for election onto one of the committees at the time, and you had to put in a case and make some little campaign, and so I was in the election, and I think I got a miserable.
Oh
miserable. So I decided that probably institutional politics was not for me. But I so the answer is I never actually joined any of the committees.
Okay.
However, I certainly have given a talk at the the local level, the IIET London
Okay.
Unit. I gave a talk there some time ago, and of course I also gave a presentation at a seminar run with yourself in when was it now? 19
It doesn't feel that long ago, but I think
19
if you mention the date, I might feel very old
It
at that
was
point.
2012.
All right.
It was
Thank you.
2012. Yeah. So in 2012, yeah. So I gave joined you in a day-long seminar and presented there. So I have spoken twice. I've also, as it happens, spoken at the Savoy Place more often than that because BT actually did hire the hall on
Right.
several occasions. So I have spoken in the
You've
in the
been to
main
the
chamber in the
building, as
main
it were.
chamber but only once as an
Yeah.
IET person.
They often say that when you go to an event like a seminar or an evening lecture organized by a professional body, there's two sides to it. There's the actual content of what you're listening to, so your technical knowledge gets enhanced because you're listening to someone talk about that particular subject. And then they refer to this thing called networking,
Yeah.
where you get to meet other people because they all go to listen and you have a coffee or whatever it is afterwards or beforehand. How valuable do you think that aspect is, that sort of it's a social network in the truest tradition of it, actually face-to-face meeting. Do you think that is a valuable thing? Has that helped you in your career?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The people that you meet and the just to gauge what the topics are at the moment to make contact with people, but you never know. I talked about this uncle relationship before,
Yes.
which I think is very important. You need to worry about who's above you, but also to the sides as well. And that's equally true about people outside of your company, outside of your circle. Really important. I wanted to just add one more thing, if I may,
Please
Nigel.
do. Yes, of
You
course.
asked me earlier, previously, about my involvement with the. Of course, I have published four books with the IET Books.
Yes,
So
it.
I that, if you like, is my contribution to mankind.
Well, I was going to say, how could you forget something as significant as that? Not just one book, but four. And so let me just delve down a little bit there then. You say published. With these are IET branded
Yeah, they're
books.
IET branded books. Yeah, IET publisher. It was IEE publisher, the first one, which was
Yes.
SPC, Digital Telephone Exchanges, and then since then it's become IET.
And I was obviously did the I mean again interested here,
Yeah.
did the IET approach you because they wanted to publish a book in this area, or were you, how does the process work? Did you propose to them an idea?
The answer is I proposed. We proposed. So the first book, which was the SPC te Digital Telephone Exchanges, that's essentially what I was teaching when I was in India during my
Okay.
3-year stint. And I myself and two BT colleagues went, we had two further UN deployments, one in two in Bangladesh, and I also went to Swaziland with the UN to do this. And so I, as part of the UN, while I went back to BT, I spent 3 weeks running this course on SPC digital telephone exchanges. And so we had these set of course notes. And so we made a proposition to the IEEE publishers then, who were the obvious people to go to, by the way. That's the important point to note. They were the only ones we thought of. And I sort of suggested we'll top and tail these notes and make a book of it, you see. And the editor at the time, his name will come to me in a minute, said, these are very nice course notes, yes, but this is a long way from being a book. And so it was actually 2 full years after that approach that the book was finally published. So I approached them at that time, and the three of us, all three at BT, so all three of us had IEEE membership, made a proposal, and they were that went well. And because of the success of that book, later on when I was running the courses for at UCL, I knew that, having dealt with the students I was dealing with, that what they really needed was a story of how all the things fitted together. And that was the theme of my three subsequent books.
All with the IET.
All with the IET. Yeah. So all of those, I approached the IET, but I have to say I had reached an understanding with them at that stage, and their various editors, I only had to sort of make brief contact, and they almost snatched my hand off. So it was an easy sell in all cases, because I'd proven myself with the first. Was important.
A known quantity to them.
Exactly.
And obviously created a book that it was of demand, as they would perceive it, to their membership. So the IEEE as a learned society, you've very much made a contribution there, because those books stay in the library and get consulted by people today, don't they, in terms of wanting to learn about these technologies, or indeed some of the older technologies that were in the first book that have now been superseded.
Sadly, yes.
We all move on. We all progress, don't we? I'm just wondering, in all of that sort of relationship that you've had from the days of a student through your membership, your fellowship, you've given talks, you've attended events, you've now just told us about these books you've published. Is there any standout event or incident that involved the IEEE that you think that was rather pivotal or really memorable to me, important to me in all of that? It's very hard to pick your favorite, I know, but does anything stand out to you as being significant in all of that time?
My answer you might think is trivial, but I was very taken by receiving out of the blue the 50-year badge, and I suddenly it came with a commending letter.
Yes.
And I was quite taken by that. I thought, the reason being, it was a personal letter to just me.
Yes.
From the IET, out of the blue, saying congratulations, and you've got this 50-year working with us, and so forth. And actually, I thought it was very nice, because it was personal. I wasn't along with a whole classroom of people. It was just me, number one. And number two, it was a nice bit of recognition. I just felt, and it sounds a little bit strange to say, but it was almost a sort of a friendly thing. I felt I was part of a group of friends.
Yeah, and
receiving that.
I do not think that's trivial in the slightest. You know, to achieve 50 years of membership of any organization, but one that is clearly very much entwined with your career, both in BT and subsequently in academia, achieving 50 years of contribution and relationship, I don't think that's trivial at all. I think that's amazingly successful and something you are rightly proud of. And I think that's excellent. I just wonder if we kind of think about drawing our discussion to a close and evaluating all of these things that you've talked about and fascinating experiences that you've had. It's, again, a bit of a difficult one to answer, but what does the IEE / IET mean for you? Can you encompass that in any simple statement? Or if you were, maybe if while you're thinking about that, if you were to try to convince the students that you've been teaching at university, and you think back to when you were that student at Loughborough, and the program leader or the IET industrial tutor or whatever convinced you to join the IEE, how would you sell it? How would you sell it to a student or someone who's just started their career now?
I think the way I would sell it is that today's people have got ready access to information through the internet. And a lot of technical stuff is pre-digested and delivered over sort of various media, social media and over, the, you know, through various routes, so using the internet as a vehicle. And there's less reading of books going on from students.
Yes.
But what I think I would emphasize is, and this is something I try and do certainly in the courses, is to try and get them to understand, okay, so this is how, you know, this is how the multiplexers work, or this is how a high speed router would work, and so on. So that's easy. But how is it used? How does it relate to, you know, how does a multiplexer and an IP router, how do they be involved in the network at the same time? And how do all these things come together? And why should a network operator, say, choose this technology rather than this technology to do something which in the end is the same functional achievement? Yes. But why would I choose one rather than another? And that's all about understanding the value, understanding what your objectives are in deploying this equipment. And so this, if you like, this contextual aspect to engineering, this contextual aspect's about seeing it from lots of perspectives. And what does help you see things from different perspectives? Well, one of the ways of doing that is, apart from group discussions, which we like to have, the other way is, on a more, if you like, systemic way, is to join an institution which can give you different perspectives on these particular engineering aspects. And one of the things with IET now they've broadened their remit to cover a wide range of disciplines with loosely the engineering technology envelope. It's all about seeing that interrelationship, the contextual part. So I think if I was to give some sort of mission to the IET, it's about helping the engineers understanding that context side, the relationship with what the market needs, what people's services are, what the financial aspects are, what sort of investment, what sort of return would you expect on this deployment, and so forth. That's all part of that big picture, and understanding that is something I think that the IET does at the moment, certainly with some of the lectures and things I've been to. But it also is something that they should keep in the back of their mind as a key driver for them, in my view.
Excellent. Yeah, so what you're saying there, I think, is it professional bodies, despite the fact the growth of YouTube and everything on the web and social media and all of the social media outlets, you think the professional bodies still have a role to play in today's society and for youngsters going into the engineering profession?
I think so. And I think it's part of, you know, they understand about social networks. Think of the IET as another social network if necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Only with this sort of this bigger remit than normal social networks.
Yeah. And I think you've demonstrated that very well in the conversation we've just had from those very early days as a student at Loughborough up through your industry and academia career. And of course, you've been involved with the IEE as a member, as you've said, for over 50 years. But you've also contributed not only talking at events, but your books. So you've actually given a lot to the professional body as well as gained from it. And I think that's a wonderful story. And all it leaves me to do is to say, Andy, thank you so much for spending your time with me today and sharing that experience and your insights and your career. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.